Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the threat of autocracy around the world and here in the United States with author Ann Applebaum. But first, ProPublica has broken a story about a Texas woman who died because she was denied life-saving medical care because doctors were afraid of the state's abortion law. This is another example of how these abortion bans are hurting women who want to have healthy childbirth. We're joined by the author of the story, a ProPublica reporter, Kavita Sarana. And Kavita, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this case.
Jocely Barnica was a 28-year-old mother from Honduras living in Houston. She was about 17 weeks pregnant in September 2021 with her second child when she went to the hospital bleeding and cramping. Doctors diagnosed her with an inevitable miscarriage. Her cervix was open and the fetus was already pressed against it, so there was really no chance of saving the pregnancy. The standard of care at that point, doctors have told us, is to offer to speed up the delivery or a surgery to empty the uterus because there's a risk for developing a life-threatening infection. But instead, Barnica waited 40 hours to deliver. Her husband told us that she was told it would be a crime to intervene because her fetus still had a fetal heartbeat. And in Texas, the six-week abortion ban had just gone into effect, and it said doctors had to record that there was no fetal heartbeat before intervening. She died of sepsis 3 days after she delivered, and we reviewed the details of this case with more than a dozen maternal health experts across the country. They said that her death was preventable, that waiting so long could have allowed bacteria in and an infection to take hold, and that's why it's so important for patients to have abortion as an option in those situations.
So if this case had happened in another state like Massachusetts, then she would have had the medical care that she needed, and she'd still be alive today.
Right. Doctors told us that if she had walked into a hospital in another state, Massachusetts, Ohio, she would have delivered within a couple of hours if she wanted that.
Now, what are the doctors? This happened at the Houston Healthcare Northwest, HCA, Houston Healthcare Northwest. What do they say about what happened?
We reached out to the doctors involved. They did not respond. We also reached out to the hospital. They said that their hospital follows the laws in each individual state, and individual physicians exercise their judgment independently.
This happened in early September. We have to be aware of where things fall in the timeline because it seems like we're still dealing with trying to understand what the Texas abortion law is. There are exceptions in the law, but we're hearing so much from Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton that he doesn't really want those exceptions used very frequently. Also, the Texas Medical Board has been wrestling with how do we communicate to doctors what they can and cannot do. What we hear from doctors is there's a lot of confusion. So did you notice that?
Exactly. We've been hearing that for years. I mean, I think it's really important to point out this case is from September of 2021. So, this is 3 years later that we're even discovering it. And we discovered it because, there's no one else really looking into the consequences of these laws. There are review boards that look into maternal deaths in every state, but in Texas, they haven't even started looking at the end of 2021. So we've been looking into these cases by requesting death records, reaching out to families, gathering medical records, and then putting the pieces together. So the consequences of this, I mean, this is one case that we discovered, but we've reported others in other states, and we're continuing to look into this. So you can go to ProPublica.org to learn more and reach out to us if you think there's cases we should be looking into.
Yeah, so last month, ProPublica, you wrote, told the story of two Georgia women whose death were deemed preventable, but they died because of the abortion laws there. And Georgia Governor Brian Kemp says that your reporting was fear-mongering. Can you respond to that?
I think since the beginning, major medical organizations and doctors have been warning that these laws would harm women. So there's been reporting on this for years. Again, a lot of some of our own reporting you could find at our website. I think that the confusion has been clear, and we I continue to ask lawmakers about specific cases to help us understand, as well as authorities. You know, we asked the head of the Texas Medical Board about this. What should patients in a situation like Barnica's expect from their doctors? And he put it on the patients and said, if they feel that their life is in danger and doctors are hesitant to provide care, maybe they are interpreting the law in a way that's incorrect, then they should vote with their feet and go to another doctor. But I think looking at this case and its detail shows how unworkable that is.
Right, because I'm wondering if there are pregnancies, crisis pregnancies, that go very badly and may end in death, and the patients and the families aren't even aware of what happened. I mean, is that possible?
That's exactly what we're finding, because we look into these cases, we reach out to families, and they have questions. They didn't even know what questions to ask. These are situations that people never wanted to face in the first place, situations they never expected to be in. So they're not sure what the standard of care is, how things could have been handled differently, what their options might have been, like you said, if they were in another state. And so it takes a lot to put those puzzle pieces together. And of course, they are living with so much grief over the loved ones they've lost.
In Texas, there was a legal battle over EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the state of Texas, saying that hospitals here in Texas do not have to provide life-saving care to women who are in a crisis pregnancy. So even though the case you write about here happened in September of 2021, it doesn't seem like much has changed.
I think the message that the Attorney General is sending to doctors is that they are right to be concerned that authorities may question their judgment in cases, and the consequences for patients are being felt in these cases we brought to light, and also many other cases of people who have filed lawsuits and shared their stories about being denied care.
And the woman you wrote about, Jocely Barrenca, she wanted to have this child. She wanted to have another baby in her life, right?
She did. She was looking forward to her pregnancy. She wanted to have a large family, her husband told us.
And so the idea that we need to, raise awareness is that these abortion bans are hurting women who want to have a healthy childbirth.
Right. They are written so strictly that they can come into play and affect situations, again, crises that nobody would expect to be faced with when they were entering into a pregnancy that was very much wanted.
And these exceptions that are in the law aren't really being applied. Is that what you're finding?
What we're finding is it's a question of interpretation. These exceptions are written unclearly and vaguely, and in Texas now, doctors are threatened with 99 years up to 99 years in prison if they don't get it right. So
they tend to weigh on the side of caution, their caution, but maybe at the cost of the mother's life.
Exactly.
Kavita Surnama, thank you so much, a reporter for ProPublica. Their latest reporting tells the story of a Houston woman who died because she did not receive life-saving medical treatment because of the abortion ban. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted more than 20 leaders of many of the world's developing nations in the Russian city of Kazan. The meeting was a display of unity of many of the world's dictators and authoritarians. Addressing a roundtable of these nations, Putin told the gathering BRICS members and guests that their countries share similar ambitions and values and a vision for a new world order. BRICS is an acronym for the initial members of this group: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Economic bloc here represents 45% of the world's population, and this here could be a sign of a gathering storm for a global conflict. In his closing comments to the summit, Putin lambasted Western nations for hoarding global wealth, goods, even concepts like human rights, climate change, and democracy, which he railed against. Simultaneously, North Korean military forces are now putting boots on the ground in Russia. They're joining Russia's invasion of Ukraine and showing a dangerous multinational expansion of that war. NATO said on Monday thousands of North Korean troops were moving towards the front line. This is a development that has prompted Kyiv to call for more weapons and an international plan to keep these troops at bay. So we are seeing more and more cooperation among authoritarian states around the globe. Anne Applebaum has written about this in her new book, Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World. She argues that the dictators of the world are working together to oppose the spread of democracy and the rule of law. And Anne Applebaum, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to kind of do something, my version of the weave, where I want to talk about this and then get to talk to about Donald Trump and what's happening with our election. And if we're lucky, maybe we can talk about Moldova. But so what do you see about what is happening with Putin and the BRICS?
So let me slightly correct something that you said in your introduction. It's just impressionistic, but it's true that what you said, that Putin is eager to create or make the BRICS into some kind of alternative world alliance. It's less clear that all the members of the BRICS want that. I mean, they're there because they are looking for economic contacts with one another. Maybe they're interested in meeting one another, but it doesn't seem like most of the world, you know, wants to create an anti-Western or anti-democratic or anti-American alliance.
Right. And, sure. This is not the meeting of Spectre in one of those James Bond movies, you know, where all the bad guys get together. I mean, many of these countries are, you know, they are, you know, developing countries, and they're trying to work together on their shared problems. But within that group, there does seem to be.
You're right. So my book is about a narrow group. I mean, this is a group of autocratic states, and what's unique about them is that they don't share a common ideology. So this is not the Cold War. So you have nationalist Russia and communist China and theocratic Iran, and whatever North Korea is, and they work together. It's opportunistically and when it's in their interest to do so, sometimes for financial reasons, sometimes to help one another stay in power. It's true that they share an attitude to power. So all these are either leaders or one-party states where the ruling elite believe that they should be able to rule without any checks and balances, without independent courts, without any independent information, without transparency, without accountability. And so they push back against those ideas inside their own countries. And there are, in many cases, certainly in Russia, certainly in China, certainly in Iran, there are people who do want rights, who do want transparency, who do want the rule of law, but they repress the ideas at home. And increasingly, they also do so around the world. And I just, to finish the BRICS conversation, one of Putin's tactics is to imply that this is the same aim as all kinds of other countries, including Brazil and India. That's not necessarily true. But yes, there is an autocratic group that does seek that. And the other thing that you cited in your introduction, namely the arrival of North Korean troops in Ukraine, which is really astonishing if you think back about it on it, you know, that the idea that a country on the really the other side of Europe, I mean, sorry, the other side of the Eurasian continent, would send troops into a war against a country that it has quarrel with, simply out of probably for financial reasons, but also out of some kind of, you know, autocratic group interest is quite extraordinary. It's not something that we would have seen ago. So they, you know, the book talks about the financial version of this, the way in which they work together economically. It talks about the military, and it also talks about them collaborating and cooperating in the world of information as well.
Right. And to be clear, the North Korean troops are in Russia proper. They have not moved into Ukraine or occupied Ukraine. They seem to be moving towards Kursk, the area where Ukraine has infiltrated part of Russia. We're not even sure the quality of these troops. They could be scrubs, might be used just to dig trenches and things, or they could be elite fighting forces. But it does seem to be, I mean, if I was South Korea, I would be moving people, my people, into Ukraine because this could be a huge intelligence opportunity.
So the South Koreans, actually a lot of our information about what's going on is coming from South Korea, and they are tracking it, and they have said that if North Korean troops are seen going into battle against Ukrainian troops, that they will, they're not going to enter the war, but they will send advisors, you know, into Ukraine to monitor what's going on. I mean, so yes, they do see this as a really serious challenge to world order. And, it, you know, they, I think they also fear that it might even be some kind of provocation designed to create antagonism on the Korean Peninsula. The North Koreans in the last few months have been behaving strangely. They blew up bridges in the demilitarized zone between the two halves of Korea. They've changed their rhetoric about South Korea. They now talk about South Koreans as not as the same nation, but as the enemy. So there's some game going on there as well. And Putin may literally be trying to provoke a war there.
So doesn't it seem, though, because in your book, you talk about these nations work together in a very fluid kind of way, but with North Korea getting involved with Russia in this manner, also Iran sending in what these really kind of dumb drones also to Russia to use, and North Korea has been sending armaments also into Russia. It seems like things are kind of gelling, or not crystallizing, it's not solidifying. It's still kind of a sloppy gel, but it's not quite fluid.
It's true there, you know, the cooperation between them is intensifying, and you can, there are lots of areas where you can look at this. I mean, there's some kind of cooperation between the Russians and Hamas, for example. The Hamas leaders visited Moscow both before and after the October the 7th events. There's North Korean drones going to Russia. The Russians may be sending weapons back to Iran to be used by the Houthis, who are another Iranian proxy group who supposedly have been given anti-ship missiles, or seem to have been given anti-ship missiles that could be used to hit American or other ships in the Red Sea. So the cooperation is intensifying. It's partly a reflection of the fact that Russia is not winning the war. A war that was supposed to be over very quickly. The Russian economy is suffering a great deal. And so the Russians are now looking at levels of cooperation we didn't see before. I mean, I think both the Iranians and the North Koreans, so certainly the Iranians I know, have hinted very heavily that their cooperation with Russia is economic. You know, the Russians pay them for the drones and pay them for other equipment. They may also be getting some kind of military advice. There's even a hint, and I can't prove it, but there's been a hint that the Russians may be offering nuclear technology or nuclear advice to the Iranians as well. So you're right that the cooperation is intensifying, and it's mostly around Russia's war effort.
Well, also seen it in Venezuela, Russian troops propping up Maduro's regime there. And I wonder if the Russian troops were more to keep the Venezuelan troops in line than to attack the people of Venezuela.
Venezuela is a really interesting member of this group as well, because Venezuela, this is a very, very weak state and very, very unpopular government that just lost an election. And the opposition, Democratic opposition, can prove they lost the election, but
by
they
70%.
Don't want to give up power. Yep, they don't want to. They don't want to give up power. And of course the army is a part of the population and the police are a part of the population. And so it's clear that the regime does fear some kind of army or police revolt. And there are reports of both Russian and Cuban troops, in Venezuela. And Venezuela really is a country that has been propped up and kept going by Autocracy Inc. So by Russian military aid, Cuban aid to the police forces and Cuban advice about repression, but also Chinese investment into Venezuelan companies. Even Iran is a country on the other side of the planet. Nothing historically or politically in common with Venezuela, you would think, but they have also cooperated with Venezuela, helping them avoid oil sanctions. And the Venezuelans have in turn apparently given visas to Hezbollah operatives, Hezbollah being another Iranian proxy, to operate in Europe. So, you know, so there's a way in which the autocratic world has kind of gathered around both for financial reasons, because they can make money out of doing it, and I think to make sure that one of their fellow autocrats doesn't fall. They've gathered around to make sure that the Venezuelan state, which, as I said, is a very, very ugly, very repressive, but also and unpopular and also unsuccessful state. I mean, Venezuela was once the richest country in South America, and now it's the poorest, thanks to a couple of decades of autocratic right. populist rule.
But it doesn't seem like any of these countries is really flush with a surplus of much to share. They all are dealing with their own crisis. And look at Cuba right now. I mean, it's been thrown back into the dark ages. It's a pre-industrial society now. What can they give each other than a few attaboys?
I mean, look, the Russians have oil. They have oil money. They have military technology. The Chinese have... have
Chinese
investment
is kind
resources.
Of playing it careful, though. They're...
The Chinese are more careful. The Chinese are less interested in undermining the global world order, or however you want to describe it. The Chinese have a stake in their trade with the U.S. and with Europe, and they don't seem to want to overturn the apple cart completely. Right now, the Russians have now cut themselves off from everybody and are seeking for alternatives. So they're in slightly different positions. Nevertheless, the Chinese have invested in Venezuela. They've sold surveillance technology to Venezuela. They've sold crowd repression technology to Venezuela. And they've done the same in many other places as well. So they're looking at making money out of the Venezuelan crisis if they can.
And Russia announced like next year they're going to making cuts to their social security program. They will be raising taxes in Russia. It looks like their economy at this war, they're starting to feel it domestically.
Yep. Yeah. No. They're certainly feeling it. Their business community feels it. Because Russia's not a democracy, it doesn't work the way it might in our country. In our country, if there was a rapid economic decline, people would demand some kind of change. There is no mechanism for change in Russia. It's not only do we not know who would replace Vladimir Putin if he was hit by a bus tomorrow, we don't know who would choose that person.
Or
there
he fell
no
out of a window.
Or he happened to fall out of a window. We don't know who would choose that person. There's no way for the public to express its desire for change. And this creates a huge sense of apathy and cynicism and nihilism in the Russian population, because they don't have any agency. They don't have any ability to change anything. And of course, that situation has been engineered by the ruling elite to prevent the population from being able to have any impact on politics. And also the way in which propaganda is used in Russia is also designed to persuade people there's nothing you can learn, there's nothing you can find out, you don't know what's true, there can't be any alternatives, you'd be better off staying home. And by the way, that kind of propaganda has been imitated and copied by other autocratic governments and autocratic movements around the world.
And we're seeing that here in the United States as we move towards Election Day. I told you we'll get into the weave. We'll do that when we come back from the break. We're having a conversation with Anna Applebaum. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine. Her latest book is Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World. And we're going to take your calls. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues after this break. The is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Ann Applebaum. She's a journalist, staff writer for The Atlantic Magazine. Her latest book is Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World. She has a podcast on Atlantic called Introducing Autocracy in America. And so people have been throwing the fascist word at Donald Trump. General John Kelly, former chief of staff, other people, they asked Kamala Harris if she thought that he was a fascist, and she said yes. What do you think?
So I should say I don't like using the word fascist in contemporary politics because it makes people think of the wrong thing. So immediately people think of Hitler and Nazis and stormtroopers and people goose-stepping up and down squares. And that's not, I don't think it's useful. I mean, technically speaking, and what is fascism? What was it? It was actually the term was first used about Mussolini, actually, not Hitler.
That's when we capitalized the F.
Yes, yes, and it means a political system where there's a single leader, where the leader has the right to break the law, where he embodies the will of the nation. So you can see why. It is true that some of Trump's language and attitudes and some of the behavior of his supporters does look like that form of government. And so technically it's correct to say what's happening does resemble things that we saw in the 1930s. It's also correct that Trump himself is using the language of the 1930s, and he seems to be doing it deliberately. He talks about his opponents as vermin. He talks about the enemy within. This is language that's really lifted out of Hitler, Mussolini, but also Stalin talked like that. He's used this expression about immigrants poisoning the blood of the nation. I mean, this is really remarkable language because it hasn't been used in U.S. politics before. Even if you look back at, certainly not in presidential politics anyway, in mainstream presidential politics, if you look back, I actually tried to find for something I wrote for The Atlantic a couple weeks ago, I tried to find previous presidential speeches that used anything similar. And I really couldn't, not George Wallace's speeches. FDR, when he talked about interning the Japanese Americans, which was a shameful event that happened during the Second World War, even then he doesn't insult them or talk about them as vermin or weeds or poison or anything like that. And so Trump is using this language. I assume it's deliberate. I assume he's doing it because he thinks that it will work. It will inspire his followers. This kind of language has worked in other contexts and other times and places. It will create enough fear in people. People will be afraid of being overwhelmed by a disease, by vermin, by traitors.
But it's a tactic to achieve power.
It's a tactic. It's a tactic to achieve power. It may also be a tactic to make people feel ready to mistreat their fellow citizens. I mean, if you have been describing them as less than human, if you've got used to that kind of language, then you're prepared to accept that the leader should be allowed to break the law in order to deal with them. I mean, this may be.
And you may be more likely to throw a firebomb in a drop-in ballot box.
You might throw a firebomb at a ballot box. If there's an attempt to claim after the election, and this seems to be something that the Trump campaign is preparing for, if there's going to be an attempt to claim that the election was somehow stolen thanks to illegal immigrants voting, you might be prepared to go along with that because these vermin, these enemies are trying to steal our election. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to use that language, and as I said, it has been used in other times and places successfully to make people angry, to make them passionate, to make them afraid.
But what he promises to do with that power, shut down media outlets that he doesn't like, jail journalists, jail political opponents, use the military to put down protest, and also mass deportations, things like that. I mean, that sounds nothing like an authoritarian or the word fascist.
It does. I mean, those are authoritarian practices. I mean, anything that in any case where the president would be allowed to break the law or define the law as his will, that is certainly authoritarianism. I mean, I think the more likely outcome in the case of if there were a second Trump presidency. It wouldn't look like Hitler. I mean, I think that's the wrong thing to look like, but it might very well look like Viktor Orban's Hungary, for example, where there was a concerted step-by-step attempt by a democratically elected leader to undermine institutions, exactly as you said, to create problems for the media, to harass them, to make give them difficulty with licenses, to threaten their advertisers or owners. That's already happening in the United States, actually. We have the example of big newspaper owners being afraid to endorse Trump or preventing their, endorse Harris, so preventing their staffs from speaking as they wished. You might see an attempt to use government institutions, so the FCC, to harass journalists, or the Department of Justice to go after the president's personal enemies. I mean, those would be steps in the direction of a one-party state or a kind of autocratic populist regime in which the ruling party began to use the institutions of the state to keep itself in power.
And without
due process, breaking the law, arguing that the president is allowed to break the law. There are a number of reasons to fear that Trump might do this. One is what you've just cited, the language that he himself uses. Another is the number of people around him who've openly advocated for that path. They include the authors of Project 2025, which is this report written by the Heritage Foundation, sure, by people who've been close to Trump and who are making exactly that set of proposals.
But there are people who say that he didn't do that the first time he was president. He could have done that. Why didn't he? And then I think about how he used the presidential pardon and how he used that to Roger Stone, Steve Bannon, people in his inner circle, Michael Flynn. He did use the pardon in a way that I think gives away the game.
He did use the pardon in a way that gives away the game. And also remember that when he was first elected in 2016, he didn't have any knowledge of how the government works. And he didn't have an idea of what to do it, nor was there at that time in the Republican Party a group of people who had those kinds of goals. He was surrounded by people who believed in the Constitution, who respected the rule of law, who understood what the roles of cabinet officers and the relationship of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the president. They understood that based on a set of norms and traditions and laws and so on. And Trump didn't have people around him who were willing to try to break the law or break the constitutional rules. Towards the very end, you did see some hints of this. He began, seeking to change. Very, very end, he began changing the leadership at the top of the Pentagon. There were fears that he was going to misuse or abuse the military. It didn't happen because there were enough people in place who were able to block it. And the fear now is that in a second term, he wouldn't be constrained in that way. He wouldn't have people around him who are trying to make him obey the law.
Right. Try to put in Jeffrey Clark as the attorney general. I'm going to go to a caller. Jose has been waiting for a while. And Jose, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hello. And hello to Ms. Applebaum. I'd like to pose an argument against her premise that autocracies may be growing as a result of countries that want to skirt world order. And I don't see world order, especially when NATO, what I see is BRICS itself being a response to American hegemony. Also, dollar dominance, which has always played a negative role and had a negative impact on the very countries that are members of BRICS, and they're trying to circumvent that. The other thing I'd like to mention is that in what alternate reality is Ms. Applebaum living in? Russia is winning this war of attrition, all right? Russia never wanted this war to begin with.
All right, Jose, thank you for that call. So that is one thing that Putin called for at the BRICS meeting, the de-dollarization of the global economy. Any response to that or whatever Jose said?
Sure. First of all, Russia is not winning the war in Russia's own terms. Russia began the war arguing that Ukraine was not a real country and that Russia deserved to occupy Ukraine, and that and the war was launched in the belief that the Ukrainian government would collapse quickly and the war, Kiev, would be captured in a few days. Officers who entered Ukraine carried with them the parade uniforms that they were going to wear. This is now more than 2.5 years ago, so no, they are not winning. The Ukrainians have won the war of the Black Sea. They have pushed the Russian Navy out of the Black Sea using drones, despite not having a navy themselves. So, you know, I know you don't want to argue about that indefinitely, but that's a genuine misunderstanding of what's happened. De-dollarization is something that it's true the Russians talk about it, or they have implied they're interested in it. So far, nobody else is, and that was actually one of the things that came out of the BRICS summit, is that the other members weren't interested in shaking up or undermining global currencies. These are countries that do have a huge amount of influence on world politics. They are countries that have a say in multiple institutions. You know, the G20 was created in order to expand the concept of global governance to include more countries. What Putin is trying to do is something a little bit different. And when he says world order, you know, the dollar and economic influence aren't really what he's interested in. What he's interested in is a world in which leaders like him can behave as they want abroad the same way they do at home. In other words, it's okay for big countries to invade small ones.
Or monkey around with their internal politics.
That's right.
Like we've seen in Moldova. I'm going to take a break here. We're going to come back, talk some more about what's happening with autocracy around the world and in the United States. And Applebaum will take your call, answer your questions. 833-877-8255. The Source continues. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin. Davies Ann Applebaum is with us. She's the author of the new book, Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World. She is a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine. Her latest piece there is Trump wants you to accept all of this as normal. The former president is psychologically preparing Americans for an assault on the electoral system. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. So Moldova, 3 million people in a country kind of squeezed in between Ukraine and Romania. They had elections recently trying to decide if they wanted to pursue membership in the EU. And it looked like that was going to win easily. But then on election day, it just squeaked by less than a percentage of a vote. This happened about a week ago. And it looked like Russia was bribing people, paying people to vote against this. Also, they're having a presidential runoff election on this Sunday. There is also a Russian ethnic minority there that they want Russia to come in and save them, an excuse that we've seen also in Ukraine. Why should we pay attention to Moldova?
So Moldova is and Georgia have both had Georgia. This is Georgia, the country,
in Europe,
not Georgia, the state. This is Georgia in the Caucasus, have just recently had elections where there was major Russian intervention. So the as you said, in Moldova, there was lots of evidence. I mean, it wasn't even very subtle, of money being spent, people being bribed to vote, paid openly. On top of an information campaign that was also backed by the Russians. In Georgia, you had a similar and even more complicated game involving, votes being ballot stuffing, results being changed and so on, also in an attempt to prevent a pro-European coalition from winning the election against their autocratic populist pro-Russian ruling party. So but in both of these cases, what you see is the Russians trying to achieve the outcome they've failed to achieve in Ukraine through electoral manipulation, games at the ballot box, and propaganda campaigns. It's simply another illustration of the lengths to which the Russians will go, and not only the Russians, as I said, we already discussed, they work together with others to make sure that democratic governments lose, to make sure that autocratic governments win or keep power. It's part of their definition of safety. You know, we need more autocracies in power, especially around us and especially in our region. You know, you could dismiss any of these. You know, these are small countries; they don't matter. But in each case, it's a step. It's a step towards spreading the ideas and practices and behaviors of the autocratic world. You know,
it's a step towards Poland. And step towards NATO and step towards
Also, Moldova is a country on the border of Romania. It's between Romania and Ukraine. It's a country that where there are Russian in a small part of the country that has been there are Russian troops who have been based there for a long time. There's been fears actually since the beginning of the war in Ukraine that they could be activated or the war could be spread in that direction. And this is clearly a part of that effort.
Let's go to Claiborne on the radio, on the telephone. Go ahead, Claiborne.
The thing with autocracies, especially with a bunch of them that are palling around together, is they're unencumbered by objective reality. They also tend to be crazy, just like when Galtieri decided to invade the Falklands for domestic political reasons. Not expecting Iron Maggie to do what she did, but imagine a scenario where the Soviets do something somewhere, Venezuela does something in the Caribbean, the North Koreans do something, and then somebody else, and Iran does something else. Our fleet and armed forces and our allies have to be postured and equipped to deal with all of that simultaneously.
All right, Claiborne, thank you for that. Are we ready for this gathering storm?
So this is why it's really, really important that the United States has allies, that we have coalitions, that we have countries who will work with us, who are joined, who, unlike the autocratic world, are joined by a set of ideas, who feel something in common. This is why it's important to have European allies and Asian allies, and allies in Africa and Latin America, who will work with us at a time of crisis. I do think that our European allies are more unified, they are better armed, and they are better prepared mentally and otherwise than they were a few years ago, largely thanks to the war in Ukraine. I think that the same is becoming true among our Asian islands. Australia, South Korea, Japan, and others are also beginning to understand the level of the threat. Being aware and being prepared are 90% of it. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote my book is that I worry that the public is not sufficiently aware of the degree to which the autocratic world works together, and isn't aware of the need to understand what democracy is, why it has to be defended, and why our defense of it, and even maybe the safety of it in our own country, also depends on our relations with so many other countries.
Many of the defenders of Donald Trump say that when he was president, Russia did not invade Ukraine because he was a strong leader and he was a wild card, and none of these countries wanted to tick him off. Why do you think Russia invaded Ukraine during Donald Trump's presidency?
So I think during Donald Trump's presidency, Putin was still hoping that he would take over Ukraine without invading it. So Putin's, you know, there are different ways to wage a war. You can wage it using a military. You can wage it politically.
The hybrid.
You're a hybrid, but also you can wage it through campaigns of information. And he was hoping that, through influence on Trump, that he could convince America to stay out, and he could create a political change in Ukraine that would be favorable to him. The closest he got was persuading, remember what was the, one of the central scandals of that administration was Trump's attempt to blackmail President Zelensky to
say, perfect phone call.
That's right. I need information about Joe Biden in exchange for us selling you weapons. I mean, why did he think Zelensky had that information? Where did it come from? Who convinced him that this was a good idea, or this was a good way to approach Ukraine? I mean, you can ask. I mean, the Russians knew that Trump had a dislike of Ukraine. They knew that he was willing to see Ukraine as a kind of bargaining chip. And they, I think they were hoping to win that way, and it didn't work out. And so the decision to invade was made a couple of years later.
Let's go to Elaine on the phones. And Elaine, you're on the air.
Yes, I have 2 points I wanted to mention. First, Trump talks about the criminals coming into the country. If he wants to know who the biggest criminal is, all he has to do is look in the mirror. Second point is, and I don't think a lot of Americans know this because a lot of them are already deceased. We're of his age. Donald Trump was a draft dodger. And that was a well-known fact. But, of course, that's a 75-year-old man now. But he was a draft dodger. And the second thing is the man he's using as his political song, God Bless the USA, Lee Greenwood, he was also a draft dodger.
Okay. Elaine, thank you for that. And I understand Donald Trump has been taking treatment for his bone spurs, and he's doing okay now. Anne, do you think that these autocracies like Putin, these in the BRICS, are they looking at our elections, and what are they thinking?
So I think they think that the nature of the United States will be decided by this election. If Americans bring back into the White House somebody who assaulted our political system, who expresses disdain for our democracy, who expresses disdain for our military, actually, to apropos of that question, who has disdain for traditions of the constitutional traditions and patriotism, then they will draw the conclusion that this is a different kind of America, an America that's not going to object when they, you know, invade their neighbors or abuse their citizens, and they will understand. It will be, you know, it's funny. We talked about Moldova and Georgia. In places like that, people are very closely watching the U.S. election for an indication of the mood of the United States. You know, will a government emerge that's willing to talk about democracy, that's interested in allies, that wants to create to increase and enforce the democratic coalition, or will there be a transactional president who's willing to do deals with dictators and who will leave smaller countries out? I mean, I think that's one of the things that's at stake next week.
And are you thinking that if Kamala Harris wins, those countries like Russia and Putin, they'll have to change, get new tactics?
I don't know that they'll get new tactics, but they'll be dealing with an American politician who is interested in coalitions, who believes in the rule of law. Who's a former prosecutor, in fact. They'll be dealing with a different kind of person, somebody who represents the things that America has stood for the last, you know, in the decades since 1945. And they'll understand that kind of America is still there.
Anne Applebaum is staff writer at The Atlantic magazine. Her latest book is Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World. She has a podcast at The Atlantic called Introducing Autocracy in America. It's a good listen. It's a fun listen. And this is The Source. Anne, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
Support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.